In 1995, can you hear? Yeah. In 1995, Tippett's 90th birthday was celebrated at the Barbican and the Royal Festival Hall with a series of concerts spanning his lifetime's work. It was called Visions of Paradise. On the last night, the London Symphony Orchestra under Colin Davis's baton gave the premiere of his final work, The Rose Lake. As the last few notes died away, a noisy demonstration erupted in the balcony. Visions of hell, they yelled. Tippett looked round, and the rest of us stood up, applauded all the more loudly and more warmly. What the protesters couldn't hear was the hard-won beauty and lyricism of a composer who had lived through two world wars, the 1930s, and that had undergone a great inner struggle to live and work as a composer in the 20th century. To become, as Tippett himself said, quoting Hölderlin, a poet in a barren age. The struggle produced music of some complexity. Like an analytic session, it's not always easy listening. In this talk, I will try to show how Tippett's creativity, his winning through of his creativity as a musician and a composer, was entangled with personal questions of masculinity and homosexuality in a world that laid down strict codes and laws for both. Psychoanalysis was a crucial experience for him in that struggle. So Michael Tippett died aged 93 in 1998, 3 years after the Barbican concert. In over 60 years of creative life, he wrote 5 operas, 4 symphonies, 5 string quartets, concertos, piano concerto and concerto for orchestra, that is, and many occasional instrumental and choral works. Near the beginning of his career, in 1941, he composed what does remain his most famous work, the oratorio, A Child of Our Time, which Andrea just referred to. 40 years later, a major work of maturity, A Mask of Time, for chorus, orchestra, and soloists, was premiered in Boston. Midway, there is The Vision of St. Augustine, itself a great meditation on time. If we think back to this morning's service, is also a meditation on music itself. Music, the simplest definition of it, being sound in time. And the opening of The Mask of Time opens with sound resounding. In these works and in the operas, he articulated the ideas that drove his artistic vision. He had been a prime mover in the revival of English and European Renaissance music in the 20s and 30s, Gibbons, Tallis, Byrd, Dowland, Monteverdi, Purcell, and others. He also wrote and gave talks on Schoenberg, Stravinsky, Britten, and others as well, and forcefully upheld the place of the artist in a world undergoing massive technological change, much of it driven by the disruptive conflicts of the 20th century. In the 1930s, he was very active in music making, local choirs in Surrey, the South London Orchestra of Unemployed Musicians, the London Labour Choral Union, and from 1940 to 1951, director of music at Morley College, where he built and encouraged the performance of early music as well as contemporary works, which included Britten, Hindemith, Stravinsky, Bartok, and others. He was also fiercely politically engaged. In 1935, he joined the Communist Party of Great Britain. And in his letter, they're on sale at the bookshop there, his letters to fellow composer Alan Bush, who remained a lifelong Stalinist, Bush died in 1995, he argues for the ideas of Trotsky, very unusual at the time, both on political and artistic grounds. Music shouldn't be reduced to political instrumentality. Individual talent went with and transformed tradition. And this, of course, is T.S. Eliot's view. Typically, the Tippett, the high Tory Eliot, was as much an influence on his thinking at that time as was Trotsky. Infuriating for people who took contrary positions, but there we go. In 1945, one of his dear friends, Francesca Allinson, committed suicide. They had met 20 years before in 1925 and shared the same political outlook. She was a musician and had introduced Tippett to the work of Purcell. She helped him out financially during the war, and though she was bisexual and Tippett was gay, they considered having children together. She suffered terribly from ill health, which got worse in the 1940s. In her suicide note, she wrote to Tippett, I'm going to be going during Germany's agony, and I don't want to survive it. And I think a hint in this is what, in the last talk, this world of Kultur, this world of civilization, which had been smashed, she didn't want to survive that. They identified with it. I can't, and towards the end of this letter, she says, and I can't live without the warm, enfolding love of another person. And in this life, I've smashed up my chance. Darling, forgive me. That warm, that enfolding love, perhaps you wished for from Tippett. I don't know if you can only speculate. This broke Tippett. He wrote to their mutual friend, David A. Hurst, "My dear David, I'm too out of my mind to be very coherent just yet. Fresca seems to have reached zero point and drowned herself in the Stour." Concluding the letter, he writes, "We were both marked, as so many of our generation have been, but perhaps my career especially got in the way, and she is part of the price. We never learn about real loss till it is there in our persons. Her going is perhaps less than the maiming and death of so many young folk, children, mothers, in this lunatic, power-driven world. But I know it sharper. She was a lovely, lovely creature, as I feel, and lived her birthright out with courage. Poor lamb. Love, Michael." Now, the question of birthright, of legitimacy and recognition, was an issue for Tippett as much as it was for Francesca. She was born in 1903, Tippett in 1905, before the smashing up of European civilization in the Great War. In 1943, Second World War was well on its way, Tippett was sent to Wormwood Scrubs. He had filed as a conscientious objector and had refused alternative work on the land, insisting on his mission as an artist in the society he lived in and wanted to see transformed. "How can I grow to a man's stature?" sings the imprisoned young protagonist of A Child of Our Time. Tippett's question too. Now, by 1969, recognition of his stature was growing. By then he had written the operas The Midsummer Marriage, King Priam, and The Knot Garden, which was due for its Covent Garden premiere the next year, in 1970. In a talk in that year, 1969, entitled Love in Opera, we find this. "The loss of love, the dying because of love, or because of the loss of love, can be thought of artistically as the primal human situation." We can immediately note the psychoanalytic resonance of this sentence, and we can also recall Francesca's letter. Now, in the previous paragraph to this, where he makes his statement about the loss of love, he notes the significance of death and dying as a verbal conceit for Elizabethan composers like Dowland and Campion. Dying and dying again was synonymous with love and loving again. There was also, of course, the romantic tropes of the great age of opera of the 19th century. All the heroes, most of them anyway, and heroines, die at the end. Desdemona, Otello, Traviata, Isolde, Tristan, and Wagner tries to appropriate the whole of Eastern and Western philosophy to Isolde's Liebestod, the end of everything. All the lovers in opera are star-crossed, and the autobiographical significance of this stands out. To be a homosexual in the 1920s, the 30s, and beyond was to be a star-crossed lover. But by 1969, the love that had done for Oscar Wilde just 5 years before Tippett was born was beginning to speak in a way that it had never done before. Nevertheless, love and loss of love was to be a recurrent story both in Tippett's life and in his work. In 1932, Tippett had met Wilf Franks. It was shattering. In his autobiography, he writes, "I'm quite sure that meeting with Wilf was a major factor underlying my discovery of my own individual voice, something that couldn't be analysed in purely technical terms. All that love flowed out in the slow movement of my first string quartet, in an unbroken span of lyrical music in which all four instruments sing ardently from start to finish."
Should be louder.
try to get it.
Can't hear it, I don't think.
Switch it off and on again.
No.
Never mind. Well, maybe Tippett had got something about technology, I don't know. So this meeting with Wilf Franks, it produces help. I mean, he's done a lot of work. He went back to the Royal College of Music in the early 30s to study counterpoint with R.O. Morris, but that wasn't enough. It was this emotional experience in this meeting. In the Cambridge Companion to Tippett, Suzanne Langer remarks that this work, 1935, the string quartet, signals Tippett's coming out to himself. The relationship with Wilf was, though, a troubled one. Wilf insisted on sleeping with Tippett without pyjamas, but for a long time, no sex. When it did eventually happen, Wilf told Tippett, "I'm only doing this for you." In 1938, Wilf and Michael met in a cafe in London. Wilf announced he was getting married. Tippett broke off the relationship there and then and turned to analysis with a man called John Layard. Now, Layard was an anthropologist and Jungian analyst. Before the First World War, he had gone with W.H. Rivers. W.H. Rivers, you perhaps know from the film's Restoration, he was a psychiatrist influenced by Freud. He treated Wilfred Owen and Siegfried Sassoon. He went with Rivers, and Rivers was also an anthropologist, he went with Rivers to the South Pacific. Layard spent a year with the people of the Malekula Islands and wrote a paper on the strict kinship codes that structured that society. And this had an influence which Jung did acknowledge on Jung's work, The Transference, The Psychology of the Transference. Layard had been an important figure for W.H. Auden and Christopher Isherwood also. He had known them both and the gay circles they'd moved in Berlin in the 1920s. Following his own therapist, a man called Homer Lane, whom I'd not heard of, he propounded a belief, and this is very much simplified, that the instincts was God. God was the instincts, one must follow them, and that Satan was the power of law and repression. Now this was a very Blakean, liberatory message for homosexuals in the 1920s and 30s, a way into thinking about themselves and accepting themselves. Jung also, with his apparent decentering of masculinity, evaluation of the inner feminine, the anima, as he called it, offered a philosophical counterweight to the oppressive message that as a queer, you weren't really a man. Tippett writes that it was consoling to read in Jung that homosexual relations between men were valuable because they produced a tenderness between them that might otherwise not get expressed. After a few months of consultations with Layard, Tippett abruptly ends the analysis after a particular interpretation. Tippett had brought a dream. It's worth quoting this in full. So this is the early dream. I was descending the stairs at my childhood home. At the bottom, I turned right into the kitchen. As I turned, an unknown girl slipped in front of me, and once inside, she went off to the left and disappeared. Before the kitchen door was the old-fashioned cooking range, and in front of this was washing hanging on the clothesline. Underneath the washing, I could see a pair of legs which I knew were Wilf's, but I couldn't see the torso. I went forward with both hands, drew back the washing so I could see the face. It was Wilf's, shining like the sun. I went to embrace him, and then a moral inhibition entered my mind. I said to myself, "But where's the girl?" I turned to the left. The girl fell dead into my arms. Now, and this is Tippett in his autobiography, according to Layard's analysis, the dream told me that if I didn't give up homosexuality, the anima would die. few days later, I ventured an alternative interpretation. If you cannot accept love with a shining face, then the soul is dead. That ended my consultations with Layard. Perhaps this is a familiar story. Psychoanalysis at different times in its history from every school has retreated from some of its most radical insights, what the transference, counter-transference ramifications might be, we can only speculate, and often around the question of homosexuality, sexuality in general, perhaps. Layard himself, on a visit to Switzerland to see Jung, had taken a homosexual dream involving Jung to the great master. Jung turns around and says, "We cannot discuss this." Tippett went on for 3 months to analyse his own dreams. They emerge prolifically, and his self-analysis proceeds on the Jungian path of individuation, bringing into balance the feminine, the masculine, the shadow, and the light. They're quite complex, but I'm simplifying. He is definitive in his description of the end of the analysis. Another dream involving Wilf. In a sort of church, some sort of mystic marriage, nothing sexual felt, it involved other figures making an act of contrition, and we were to make some sort of act of forgiveness. This is after this bitter breakup. So this is the turning point of the dream, of the therapy. This, he writes, was the turning point. Then, 3 nights before the war broke out, I had the classic dream of a forced death. I was going to be strangled by 4 men. I accepted it. A kind of rebirth was happening. I stopped writing down my dreams. 3 days later, on the 3rd of September, 1939, the war began. Simultaneously, I started writing the music for A Child of Our Time. Now, the oratorio, A Child of Our Time, loosely follows the format of a Bach Passion or a Handel oratorio. It is based on a contemporary story of persecution. Herschel Grinspan is this 17-year-old Polish Jewish boy that you referred to. And he's desperate to find what's happened to his family. They've been deported to the border by the Nazis. So he goes to the German embassy in Paris. This is 1938. And when he meets resistance, official resistance there, he gets out a gun and he shoots this Nazi diplomat, who dies 2 days later. In revenge, Goebbels launched the terrifying pogrom known as the Kristallnacht, when Jews across Germany and Austria, their businesses and synagogues, were destroyed. Now, the story appears in the oratorio, and it's related by the soloists in conventional recitative and aria. And as with the Bach Passions, there is a collective response from the other character, the chorus. But in place of the Lutheran chorales in Bach's day, Tippett finds an inspired equivalent in the Negro spiritual. The opening chorus sets the scene, a new universal tragedy of eternal return. So the universality is going to contain this very contemporary story. The world turns on its dark side. It is winter. The narrator then evokes the political situation in the late 30s. Pogroms in the east, lynchings in the west, Europe brooding on a war of starvation. So historical time, there are two temporalities, historical time is woven into cyclical or universal time. Life is precarious. Many identify with the persecutors. Tippett identifies with the scapegoat, the Jew, the Negro, the unemployed, but not openly as a homosexual. It wasn't possible then. The tenor sings of Tippett's predicament, which is that also of many of his time, so there's this identification. I'm caught between my desires and their frustration. Before the final ensemble and spiritual, there is an alto aria. The alto contralto voice represents the aunt in the story, the contemporary story, the boy's aunt, but also symbolically she represents the soul or the, in Jungian terms, the anima. She sings, "The soul of man is impassioned like a woman. She is as old as the earth, beyond good and evil, the sensual garments. Her face will be illumined like the sun." This is the time of his deliverance. "Her face will be illumined like the sun." Now we can hear this in relation to the dream he had brought to Layard. Wilf's face, when he draws back the washing line, there's Wilf's face shining like the sun. Her face will be looming like the sun. Tippett's analytical resolution, that is, acceptance of his desire, are subsumed into the collective drama of the time, 1939-1941. Despite the boy's tragedy, the challenge is to live, to create, for those of us that hear the work, that carry on. "Dare the grave passage," sings the narrator. "Here is no final grieving but an abiding hope," sings the mother. "The moving waters renew the earth. It is spring," sings the aunt. Then the rapturous melismas, the wordlessness, we talk about words and music, what music is without words, melismas of the soloists as their historical personalities become universal, leading into the full choral rendering of the final spiritual, Deep River. Now, in a postscript to his account of his analysis, this was in the 1980s, in a BBC interview with Anthony Clare, what was it called, On the Couch or something? The psychiatrist's chair. The vital thing, Tippett says, it seemed to me, was that the therapy reached a conclusion. Who says that now? The quarrel inside myself, instead of interfering with my creativity, now enhanced it. I had greater control over my powers as a composer. I also realized the human imaginative power of the dream life. Meanwhile, the process of individuation, as Jung called it, produced an acceptance that I would not be married. I was thus ejected out into the world as a loner. That's the end of the analysis, that's his conclusion. And it's paradoxical. The end of the analysis is apparently bleak. The loner ejected. And yet the oratorio ends full of hope. And The Midsummer Marriage, which was composed over the next 10 years, the first opera, glows with exuberant lyricism and joy. Tippett's style in this time gets richer, more layered. The influence of the Elizabethan rhythmic and polyphonic style have been fully absorbed. And it all comes together with an almost Wagnerian command of orchestral and choral forces. Now, the opera had originally been conceived as a masque, Q-U-E. And the masque dates from the 16th century, and there'd been a revival in the early 20th century. Both Vaughan Williams and Elgar had composed masques. And in the Elizabethan and Jacobean period, there had been a kind of court pageant. There were pieces of elaborate propaganda, if you like, disguised as mythological stories set in a golden age, with symbolic characters who personified chaos and despair, and then harmony brought about, of course, by the rule of the Stuart monarchy. So Tippett's masque, in the early 40s, evolved into the opera. The title, The Midsummer Marriage, situates us, actually, in the world of comedy. That's not the world of Don Giovanni, but the world of The Marriage of Figaro, or Shakespeare, Midsummer Night's Dream. There's a classic situation of a father asserting his rights over a daughter going her own way. Also, like the magic flute, there are two couples who go through spiritual trials. Tamino and Pamina are Mark and Jennifer in Tippett's opera, and Bella and Jack are Papageno and Papagena. The couples are initiated, as it were, through ritual dances, each characterized by an element and a season, fire, earth, water, air, spring, summer, and so on. The climax in Act 3, Fire in Summer. The father is determined to find his errant daughter. Now, in the middle of the stage is this huge dome covered in black veils. This character is Madame Zozostris, a clairvoyant. Now, the father, who's called King Fisher, goes up to her and consults her, at first respectfully. "Excuse me, Madame Zozostris, where is my daughter?" But being a clairvoyant, she can only answer in riddles. So he gets desperate. And in this act of desperation, he desecrates Zozostris, tears away her veils, only to discover his daughter in an act of copulation with her lover. But this being opera, and especially it being a Tippett opera, we see them sensationally transfigured. It is a divine copulation. They have become the great Hindu gods Shiva and Shakti. Overpowered, the father drops dead. Now, there's a nod here, I would say, to the composer's past. Perhaps more Blake than Trotsky, Kingfisher is a Philistine capitalist. Mark, a young man of unknown parentage, full of revolutionary, poetic, and phallic love. Jennifer, a woman who has put off love at first to find truth. And it's a reconciling of these two, truth and love, which results in the marriage and the death of the Philistine father, who can't contemplate either, apparently. Now, at the world premiere in 1955, conducted by John Pritchard, the public were bemused. The first Jennifer was sung by a relatively unknown singer called Joan Sutherland. She couldn't make head or tail of it. Though, of course, she sang it like a dream, and you can find it at the Covent Garden shop, that you can find something. It is an extraordinary rendering of it. With later recordings, notably Norman Del Mar and Colin Davis, the opera became a hit, and there have been productions since which have worked well. Now, the climax, Act 3, this scene of unveiling, are Tippett's dreams put to work. The early dream and the penultimate dream before he ends his self-analysis. And just to recap, I went forward with both hands, drew the washing back, Wilf's face shining like the sun, the girl fell dead in my arms, the father fall dead. And in the penultimate dream of his self-analysis of the mystic marriage and the act of forgiveness. It's worked its way into the opera. Now, Tippett had discussed a lot of the ideas for the opera with a man called Douglas Newton, with whom he had had a relationship throughout the Second World War. Initially, they were both going to work on the libretto, but eventually Newton sort of falls away. In his letters to Douglas Newton, who was always referred to as Den, or as Tippett often signs off, Mein Denlein, Tippett pours out his erotic feelings for him and elaborates freely on his ideas of sex, sexuality, masculinity, femininity in the process. He is an ardent lover, but constantly puts aside his own expectations in courting this younger, rather ambivalent man. Don't worry about queerness or not. The acts of love aren't altered or disturbed by that problem. To love any intimacy never precludes another at another time. And he's at pains to reassure him, proposing a masculine rapport in their discussion about books and music, and sensitivity, the feminine within us, as an eventual source of wit and strength. And he signs off the letter, almost throwing this ponderousness to the winds. He concludes, anyhow, follow the instincts however they come out and take the joy as it flies. Much love, Mike. I think in the same letter, there's a very symptomatic sentence where he writes, I have an idea that the spiritual or artistic creators is of its, artistic creativeness is of its own nature bisexual. But it's curious that neither in the oratorio, Child of Our Time, nor in the Masque, the Midsummer Marriage, is queerness projected. Not projected, but masked as tragedy in the oratorio, and as comedy in the opera. But it's there but not there. In 1929, a psychoanalyst and follower of Melanie Klein, Joan Riviere, wrote a paper called Womanliness as Masquerade. Riviere states that womanliness could be assumed and worn as a mask, both to hide the possession of masculinity and to avert the reprisals expected if she were found to possess it. And she develops this into a detailed analysis of these tensions as they appear in cases of homosexual and heterosexual women. Now, this is later taken up and elaborated by Jacques Lacan and Judith Butler, their focus on the differential power relations as they are discursively produced by the linguistic categories of masculine and feminine. So this is well away from Jung, where masculinity and femininity are a kind of essentialism within us. We're in the world, in a different world, a world of discourse and language, with those later psychoanalysts and theorists. So if womanliness is a masquerade worn to avert male hostility and rivalry, Ribier's logic can be applied to manliness, a mask worn by men to avert any sign of femininity. Any slippage excites opprobrium, fear, and potential violence. Consequently, homosexuality is lived through an ambiguous play of revealing and concealing. The wiles or tricks, as Tippett called them, he said he would live by these tricks, of the closet. Now, by the time of the Covent Garden premiere of Midsummer Marriage in 1955, England was becoming more affluent, but there was still a conservative, or there's perhaps even more of a conservative, very stagnant cultural climate for anyone who was different or dissident. Tippett's first opera was an explosion of joy amidst the conformity, but no one but the intimates knew what went into it and what personal hopes and fears it both revealed and concealed. The atmosphere of the Midsummer Marriage is a different again to the atmosphere, for example, of Britain's first opera, Peter Grimes, which appeared in 1945. Tippett had known Benjamin Britten since 1934. In 1960, he wrote to him, saying he had initially been very happy. At last, a relationship was beginning to flourish between him and Carl Hawker, only to fade again. I wanted a home so much. I never found anyone before I loved who wanted to make a home together. You and Peter, that's Peter Pierce, are such a rare union. Thank heaven it sometimes happens. However, musically, in those years, the late 50s, early 60s, there's a really big stylistic change. King Priam, the second opera, how much more time?
Only a few minutes left. If we want to have some time for discussion, right. We have to stop.
Okay,
I'll
King Priam, there's a huge change musically. There's these rich textures are paired right down. One violin, one cello accompanying a singer, antiphonic brass. But my argument about King Priam is that the ambiguity in certain Child of Our Time and Midsummer Marriage is actually lessened. It reappears again in The Not Gone. And Tippett's view of archetypes becomes kind of eternal. He makes statements like, Priam is an opera about war, of fighting men, perhaps of some men always, and similarly rather sort of archetypal or stereotyped kind of ideas about women. So, in the 60s, English social and cultural life was beginning to relax. Decriminalisation of abortion, homosexuality, youth culture, and so on. Tippett visited America in 1965, age 60, and he found this. You know, he could relate to people. His music was going well there on the campuses and so on. He liked the landscape. And this influences his later work. I'm only going for the Knock Garden. And he also became very much influenced by the music of Charles Ives. And things were beginning to change in his personal life, too. He met Marion Bill Bowen, who wrote to him from university. They became lovers and collaborators right until his death. They had to meet in secret until about 1974 because the relationship with Carl was so bad. He was extremely jealous. So they couldn't meet openly. So by the time The Knot Garden is written, 1969 and 70, it's over 30 years since Tippett dismissed his analyst. The opera opens with a storm in the garden, a storm in the Paradise Garden. A figure appears. Who is he? An analyst. Layard? Young? Tippett himself? Tippett calls him Mangus. And this character observes and facilitates the action between the personalities, very contemporary personalities, unlike in King Priam, who are in the opera. Act two, Mangus, the analyst, takes on the mantle of Prospero in The Tempest, the man of power, the magician. Layard, apparently, was known as the magician. And the 60s, of course, produced lots of charismatic figures, gurus and analysts. R.D. Lang, for example, The Knot Garden, Knots, he wrote a treatise on human relationship, and I think this is taken from that. Now, in the garden, there first enters Thea, the estranged wife of Faber. Their daughter Flora, soon joined by Dov, a white musician, and his black boyfriend, Mel, a writer. Now, they're all in very heightened states of anxiety. Flora, in flight from her father, unconscious fantasies and desires on both sides. Thea in retreat from her husband, keeping to her garden. Faber in retreat from his wife, fleeing to his factory. Dov and Mel, who are the first gay couple in opera, are about to break up. They're all shattered by the arrival of Denise, Thea's sister, obviously badly injured, both physically and psychically. She is a 60s freedom fighter, and she's been tortured. Shocked and chastened by her searing aria, they conclude Act One with a blues, which brings a blues ensemble, which brings some relief and discharge of emotion. Act Two, they take up these characters from the Tempest and all meet and clash in various roles, and the conclusion is that Flora runs off, like Miranda, to a brave new world. Thea and Faber, the husband and wife, approach each other with some kind of newfound desire. Denise and Mel, the black guy, they pair off, but whether this is heterosexuality or some kind of solidarity is ambiguous. Dov, the white gay composer, is left alone. Like Tippett, at the end of his analysis, he is ejected into the world as a loner. As to Mangus, the analyst, there's a simple stage direction. Mangus disappears. The fate of all analysts, perhaps, once they've done their job, they disappear from their patients' lives. The transference dissolved. Or so the story goes.
No, it doesn't.
Dov appears, I've nearly finished, Dov appears in subsequent work. He's been left by his lover and the others, but Tippett gives him some more songs to sing. And so I think Denise, the wounded revolutionary, comes back in the great soprano blues ending to the Symphony No. 3. Dov and Denise are living channels for Tippett of the two great artists that were for him the archetypal, that's his word, inspirational figures for his life's work, Beethoven and Shakespeare. In Symphony No. 3, after a cataclysmic quote from the last movement of Beethoven's Ninth, she sings a blues. The great Schiller Beethoven dream, Freude, Schöne, Götterfunken, Tochter aus Elysium, mourning the dream of heaven on earth as it had appeared in 1789 and was to reappear again in 1848, 1917, 1968. Denise goes into a whirlwind of rage. She has seen the gulag, the ovens at Auschwitz, the maimed, the dispossessed, the cruel. Paradise followed by persecution, followed by more dreams. But this time, unlike the boy in A Child of Our Time who goes under in the clash of powers, she lives on to reconcile the terrible. The torture, in beautiful passage, the torturer was my sibling. And lastly, songs for Dov. He is the loner at the end of the opera, at the end of the analysis. Journeying round the world, Soviet Russia, California, the paradise of the warm South, singing, quoting, witnessing the fragments of the civilization, or as we heard in previous talk of a fractured 20th century Kultur, smashed by conflict and world wars. The Flying Dutchman, Pasternak, Goethe. He is Ariel and Mignon, the transitive boy-girl, girl-boy, dreaming of and finally finding a measure of freedom. For Dov, there is no tragic sacrifice and no comedic ending in marriage. So the masks of tragedy and comedy have gone. So Dov, like Tippett, holds out the metaphor, the music, for the poet in a barren age, and for a life free of tricks and illusions. It's a kind of coming out, if you like, in many ways. I will end this talk with the Shakespearean simplicity as expressed in the motto of the Knot Garden, its parolis, the scoundrel soldier's declaration as he is unmasked at the end of All's Well That Ends Well. Simply the thing I am shall make me live.
Thank you very much, Stephen, for what? All right, yes. We'll have a brief discussion, a few minutes for discussion, for questions. I think this was very enlightening report on Tippett, on his life and on his work. For anybody interested to find out even more about Tippett, I suggest Bill Bowen's biography on Tippett. I can't remember the title.
Those 20th Century Blues.
Yeah, that's right. Which is fascinating text. Just correct me if I'm wrong. I understand that Tippett, T.S. Eliot, and Benjamin Britten would meet regularly to play Monopoly. You don't know about that?
I don't know about that.
Right? Well, it's very interesting.
T.S. Eliot was consulting T.S. Eliot to write the words
right,
for Child of Our Time,
right.
But Eliot said, you do it.
Right. And just one thing about The Child of Our Time, which I thought, as a psychoanalyst, was interesting. The reason why the child, which is the 17-year-old Polish boy who was then in Paris, killed the Nazi diplomat, the reason that was given was because he was frustrated that he had gone to the embassy a number of times to get a visa for his mother to join him from Poland, and he wouldn't get anywhere, and eventually he shot him. And of course, the Nazis were ready for an excuse in order to start Kristallnacht and so on, and that obviously lent itself very well, that's what Jews are like, and so on and so forth. So I thought that was... But the fact that it was to get his mother with him, I thought was in itself significant. Anyway, we have a few minutes for some questions before we move to the last speaker today. Would like to...
Well, I was curious to know more about his analysis with Layard. I know Layard wrote an article about homosexuality, but I didn't know that Tippett actually had been his patient. Where did you find those information? What's the source he used?
Those 20th Century Blues.
That biography.
But also, I sort of looked up on London Review of Books around 1980. There is some, I think there's something about Auden's life. And Auden and Isherwood knew Layard in the 1920s in Berlin. Layard himself was quite a troubled person. And there's a story about Layard one day of some disappointment, whether it's to do with his sexuality or what, there's lots of different versions of it, shoots himself, apparently in the mouth, but somehow he missed. And he goes round to knocks W.H. Auden's door in Berlin and said, here you are, Winston, and gives him the gun and said, finish me off. And Auden apparently says, don't be such a bloody fool, and takes him to hospital because he didn't want to be on a murder rap himself. So fortunately for us, both of them carried on with some kind of creative life. But he went on seeing people until the 60s. He died in the mid-70s.
And anyway, for a psychoanalyst to kill himself would be a way for an analyst to disappear as the character in the opera. And I would say that it's not part of analysis for the analyst to disappear at the end of the analysis. Quite the opposite. The analysis, it seems to me, can only end when the analyst and the analytic process as such is internalized by the patient. So there is no disappearance, really.
I think in the autobiography, I think there's some narrative smoothing. That ended my consultation with Layard. In fact, he wrote to Layard.
Continually a relationship of the sort.
But not formally. But I think the disagreement about the interpretation is a crucial one and a critical one.
Yeah.
And Tippett's sort of immense troubledness about his sexuality, but his determination to sort of bring that, his determination as a composer, saved the day, really. Because I think the analyst was frightened, you see, at that point.
Yeah, but isn't that an instance of what I was trying to say this morning about not being listened to? And how that could lead to rage, really, which is probably what happened. He felt he wasn't heard,
But I think also, it's a problem of how you could probably hear that at that time.
Yeah.
Because the discourses, psychoanalysis in itself, or Jungian analysis in itself, was not adequate to listen to gay people. Of course it was, in one way. But, I mean, and I wonder whether it's a little bit like the story of Thomas Mann's family, who discussed nothing else but homosexuality. Well, this is in the 1950s. What was the discussion like? How could it be conducted when there was no public discourse which you could have a discussion without it being created by fear and guilt.
Yeah. Mm. I think it's very noticeable, can you, but I'm probably all right without the microphone, actually, that where the sequence of the dream is when he has a moral inhibition, then the soul dies, and you can see why he had the courage to go with his own reading of that dream.
Yes.
Because the shining light was the love in whatever form.
Yes.
And it was his moral inhibition that kills the girl, which is, you know, whichever way you look at it.
That's
the courage he had to hold on to that in the face of authority.
Yes.
I think he had tremendous strength.
Yes.
I mean, I knew about Layard as an anthropologist, and he wrote a paper about initiation rites. And he was one of the first people to write about initiation rites, that when you go into the hut as a young man, what happens is a homosexual encounter. So it's quite, you know, the dream is going into a room. You know, there's a possibility of homosexual can something dies, and of course the initiation rites are about killing the feminine for young men. And so, you know, it's just interesting that he didn't see the relevance to what he'd already written as an anthropologist. Mm. So, but anyway.
Well, I think he probably didn't see it because he was frightened by what was going on between them, I would guess.
You know. Okay, we have...
Yeah, no, I was just going to say, Stephen, that I just reminded of some parallel with the shining face, you know, and at the end of Death in Venice, when Aschenbach looking over at Tadzio, you know, dancing in the standing there like Apollo and the sun setting down, you know, that parallel just sort of came to me then between the two sort of things, that there's this shining light in both of those cases. Like,
and there's a light and the darkness in the idea of the shadow in Jung as well, isn't there?
Yeah.
All that.
Yeah. Okay, we should move to the next picture. The next speaker is Beate Perry. Can you join me here? And... she's a German pianist and musicologist, and she's going to talk about mixing memory and desire, the voice of Freud, Schubert, and Schumann. Interesting title, considering that the psychoanalyst Wilfried Bion suggested we should go into each psychoanalytic session without memory or desire. I don't know if you were referring to that directly, but that's what he says, and that's something that I've always objected to myself. All right. Please.
But given that my title uses quote from T.S. Eliot, I suspect that...
Yeah, that Bion has taken it from T.S. Eliot, absolutely.
I'm aware that there are quite a few people here in the room who do speak German. Can you hear me in the back? Is that all right? You can't?
The microphone is not working.
Yeah.
Is it working now?
No, no, keep it there.
Is it working? Is this better?
Yes.
Yeah, better. All right. So I'm aware that people here, some of them at least, speak German, and classical music in German is regularly being referred to as ernste Musik. That means serious music. And this conference is about the impact of music and musical composition and performance and its emotional impact. And I'm here really more speaking as a performer than a scholar. But as a performer, I have to say that satisfaction and joy I mostly obtain by playing serious music or music that has a very serious content. And that is generally the kind of music that is most moving and most impressive in that particular sense. But it sounds perhaps paradoxical that the message that is serious in music is also the one that one looks forward to as a performer. But I also believe, and that is something that not everybody might be aware of, that the message that is most difficult to express, both by the composer as by the performer, is also the message that really procures most joy. So in other words, the joy that you can feel as a performer may not coincide necessarily with the joy that might be expressed in the music, and vice versa. And so with this sort of more long-winded introduction, I'm coming to my disclaimer. It's a very, very beautiful day today, and the songs that I'm going to present you are rather serious songs. So it's paradoxical, but I feel that the talk that I've been preparing is something like an extended advertisement for German song. So you tell me what you feel about these songs after my talk. Music has this singular capacity to move us. And I believe this is very much to do with the fact that it is pre-verbal. Music is pre-verbal music is pre-verbal in that it uses, materially speaking, expressive properties that are in form of vibrations and sound waves that are very much characteristic of the emotional experience. In this way, then, music captures something that is not only beyond language, as one often refers music to, but actually prior to it. And that's why it's so uniquely visceral and therefore quite powerful. But of all forms of music, and not just classical music, or indeed just European music, song stands out in its capacity to move. And this is clearly due to the human voice, the presence of the human voice in song. But no doubt, there are voices and voices too. There's the idealized, authentic voice of any centered self. And there are all those other voices that are essentially deflections from the authentic voice, transforming it to belong to a decentered self. But no matter whether centered or decentered, the voice always speaks of a part of whatever else it may be speaking about. That voice always speaks of the body to which it belongs. For the voice is what we bear. It envelopes the body like the words we speak. The voice also makes the body like the words we speak. This is why listening to the singing voice, particularly in the German art song, is an engrossing experience. For although the singing voice is certainly an artifact of the human voice, as much an abstraction as any instrumental voice, song nevertheless enlists the human presence literally. Through the singer. He is on stage. In this sense, independently of compositional style or historical moment, song will always be a figurative art. It focuses on the human figure. Its commitment is to making an image of that figure and to producing a human likeness. Song then, unlike any other musical genre, uses a real voice to make an artificial image of itself. And so intriguingly, song is at once fact and image. Song transforms the literal world into a figurative one while retaining the intensity of both, of life and of art. Since the singing voice is written for as well as performed in the first person singular, the utterance of one unique poetic speaker, the thoughts and emotions expressed lie within that poetic singer. another figure, the Lovett, for example, may be evoked, but she is not, in fact, really materially there. She isn't part of the song. And so in the absence of several interacting characters, and because of the impossibility of relations forming between a polarity of figures of the singer and the beloved, for example, no plot, no story, or narrative really develops. This is how a song succeeds in generating its subject's sensations and subjects in both of its senses without the need for narrative. It offers us both the image of the subject and the image of the sensation, a sensational subjective image. The German art song and the romantic or modern lyric poem are generally one and the same. We, listening to the song, not only, as has always been true for the reading of a lyrical poem, overhear the poetic speaker, we must combine this claim with the recognition that lyrics, unlike novels, are also spoken by the reader. When we read a lyric, aloud or silently, we utter the words. We temporarily occupy the position of the speaker, so that we too can say, I fall upon the thorns of life, I bleed, or let me not to the marriage of true minds admit impediments. We are not simply overhearing the speech of another whom we strive to identify from this speech, but we are ourselves trying on this speech. Jonathan Culler has very beautifully written about this particular dynamic in reading poetry. The short form, or the short format of the German art song helps to distill the lyrical image and conveys more acutely the sensation of its subject. It is in this way, when matters are distilled down into one image and one sensation, however ambiguous it may turn out to be, that the senses can be drawn by a different kind of dramatic charge, not one similar to operatic or social drama, but one much more intimate than that, lying within the subject in terms of theme as well as figure, and shaping its interiority. While story, as a story or a narrative, generally means a movement towards fact, image, on the other hand, mood and sensation mean a letting go of fact as we move towards a different kind of reality, a reality in which sensation is focused into great intensity and feeling is raised to its full grandeur. I want to play now the very first song of altogether three examples, which many of you will probably know. It's Die Mondnacht. On your handout, I think on the second page, the songs are completely in disorder on your handout. And you might want to follow both German and English, however you like.
Es war, als hätte er ihn I think it was a recital from 1956. Without wanting to point in detail with any kind of detailed music journalistical kind of precision, you've picked up in listening to the song the main themes that I've just evoked in the first part. And that is the more harmonious, extremely enveloping version of the German art song. We now move on to a different kind of theme. When recognizing the symbolic nature of a song and a poem and the greatly manifold semantic potential either contains, we cannot be satisfied with perceiving mere appearance or with stating only the obvious. For to look, or looking, and to listen is a movement or an activity that really aims to recapture. The gaze does not exhaust itself immediately. It is rather as if animated by the hope of adding to its discovery or reconquering what is already about to escape. There is a kind of impatient energy that inhabits the act of looking and listening and the desire to see something other than what is given. All this bespeaks, of course, the capacity which reminds us of what Adorno often called the work's surplus, das Meer, all that which is present latently in the meaning of a work of art, whether a song or a poem, and which surfaces once we allow some freedom of movement for our natural desire to explore it in its very materiality and beyond. Song itself does just that. It passes through words into music to realize a semantic potential. In so doing, it engages the senses through the eyes, the ear, and the touch to enhance how the word feels, how the words in the poem feel, and to up its meaning. The inner movements involved in the experience of fear, for example, and its destabilizing, fragmenting effects are echoed in some of the romantic composers' transpositional efforts of catching hold of mobile, momentary, and transient feelings and states of the mind, of images, and of emotional states. Schumann has composed a very famous song that I want to play for you now as well, Zwielicht, Twilight, where the emotional experience of fear becomes palpable.
Und blasen. munter.
The song in the back, it sounds, it's so even very soft here. and it's very, it's a very delicate art. So these are very, very subtle movements that are going on within a song that is a world condensed and very, very sort of concentrated. And I wonder whether the details were audible at the end, for example. Those who were able to hear will have heard that there was a whole suspense all the way to the moment where the first person, the singer, turns into somebody who's extremely suspicious and actually suspects that his friend is turning into an enemy. So this is one of the examples of a rather ingenious way of setting to music an emotional, a particular emotional state. And composing in this particular way is thus uses and fuses natural energies with those of the human imagination and miraculously begins to equal the experience of fear itself. By way of freeing the endlessly changing rhythms and harmonies of thought and feeling, composing is no longer about the idea of movement alone, but is movement itself. It shapes time. And by shaping time, it shapes experience. This song, Zwielicht, and a whole number of other romantic songs, not only by Schumann, but not particularly by Schubert, unfold in front of us like changing vistas of an inner self, where subjectivity in both the romantic and the modern sense means Erfahrung rather than Erlebnis, that is to say, experiencing and going through something rather than looking at something from the outside. And where the poet-singer is a dreamer traveling through emotional states with alarming mobility. So I'll be asking questions, and I've been asking questions about the German art song in particular, and about the very nature of romantic song and the speaking voice within it. Bearing in mind the romantic concept of subjectivity and taking into consideration all that we associate with the stereotypical image of the romantic artist, that sense of an introvert, hypersensitive, but also solitary and thus heroic individual, all this leads me to conceive, hermeneutically speaking, of romantic song as a phenomenon that draws out the theoretical consequences as regards this romantic disposition. If Novalis, one of the major thinkers and poets and philosophers of the time, of Schumann and before Schumann, speaks of an inner self-division, I quote, and Friedrich Schlegel, of a divided mind, the question to be asked is how this division affects manners of writing, how it asserts itself within language and within the language of song in particular. In other words, how do you feel it in composition? Given the early romantics' conception of language and subjectivity, we come to recognize the operating of language on two planes of experience, which Schumann eloquently describes in one phrase, and I quote, "Sometimes I feel as if my objective person wants to separate itself entirely from the subjective one, or as if I stood between my appearance and my being, between figure and shadow." End of quote. What remains to be noted, however, is the silence reigning between the objective and the subjective, and the void separating the figure from its shadow,
that very space where poetic language constitutes itself in the desire to speak of the gap in our existence. And it is through this desire that a second world, and I quote from Novalis, a subterranean firmament, in short, the realm of the imaginary and unconscious, is summoned. When Schumann then says, and I quote again, the darkness of the imagination or its unconscious remains its very poetry, my interest here lies in extending the epistemological concern to the level where it can address this apparently abstract idea through forms, gestures, and concrete signs perceptible in the musical text. By adopting the model of the unconscious introduced by Freud, in particular what is generally known as the split within the subject, Ich-Spaltung, I'm proposing the presence of the other in Schumann's song, that which can be called the romantic, solitary, phantasmatic other, to be located in the singing voice. Of course, the voice of the piano, in inverted commas, becomes an analytical issue closely bound up with this idea of the singing voice. This also raises the question of meaning with regard to the voice in the piano and in the wordless preludes of romantic songs, or interludes sometimes, or sometimes very long postludes. In Schumann, certainly, the piano does not merely form a supportive accompaniment to the voice, but rather keeps disrupting and contradicting it, remains silent, or speaks to itself once the singing voice has ceased. The piano is thus one side of the Janus-faced structure of Schumann's song. The principal mode of speaking performed by Schumann in his songs is essentially that of soliloquy, or to remain within the early romantic philosophical caste, monologue. In constant self-reflective discourse, the song realizes structurally the romantic hero's operation to identify the low self with a better self. This means an invocation of the other in terms of an interlocutor who may fill the existential gap. But this gap is also what defines the romantic solitary. It is the site and source of his hallucinations. Although there is thus always a voice that answers, the song, however, never truly fills the gap, but rather widens it. For the romantic art song's theme is always the impossibility of abundance, the absence of the beloved, or the poet's solitude. Metaphorically assuming a kind of mirror situation, the singer, elevated through the power of his invocation and amatory idealization of the other within the image of its own voice, the imago of the beloved, moves closer towards this, his own image. But the idea of the unconscious and the presence of the other had been explored even before Schumann, namely and famously so by Schubert. And now I would like you to listen to Der Doppelgänger, one of the most famous songs by Schubert.
And finds itself, and search for the eye is inwardly dramatic in romantic and songs like this one. Dramatic moments then occur when a true self-encounter is recognized as impossible. At these moments of emotional intensification, one may speak of a falling apart of the romantic hero and of fragmentation in the sense of the mirror falling into 1,000 pieces. Desire is then, in its constant attempt to fill the romantic's longing, the force that leads to fragmentation. In the romantic sense, however, both Schubert and Schumann in their Lieder are not exclusively interpretative. Rather, both composers were preoccupied with what was elusively absent from the written work. Freeing themselves from complying with the text in the spirit of becoming a second author of the poem, and with the awareness of a better understanding of any poem they were sitting to music, both Schubert and Schumann are firmly grounded within the hermeneutic tradition of the early Romantic movement. With this vision of a higher sphere of art, Schumann and Schubert's Lieder thus epitomize the quintessential romantic paradox of creation and critique. This brought into song composition a degree of unrestrained creativity, which led to the kind of intensity that we instantly recognize to be at work in both Schubert and Schumann songs. So in the language of the Romantics, Schubert and Schumann's Lieder speak the language of the soul, the romantic expression of evoking the unconscious, a soul which has found its imaginary alter ego. In the imagination of the composer, the singing voice thus becomes the haunting vision of another, second I, which promises fulfillment. In this sense, Schubert's and Schumann's Lied is the Janus-faced fantasy of the composer's amorous soul, an invocation of the other as projected in the voice versus the genuine gesture of the piano, yielding or resisting or repeating or anticipating. That signal that the signal of the romantic hero's solitude. The romantic Lied symbolizes that constant state of ambiguity which desire ensures is kept in motion. The piano leaning forward into the voice and recoiling back on itself is the space where the desire is inscribed, within which the image of the other is fixed as the pole for identification as well as alienation. Thank you.
For the beautiful opportunity of listening to some beautiful Lieder. Of course, German and Austrian culture have dominated also, not surprisingly maybe, considering the origins of Freud and the origins of so much great music. We've had, of course, a contribution from Britain with the paper about Michael Tippett, but otherwise we've mostly talked about German language, culture, and that's, I think it's been, you would agree, a very rich day with contributions from so many different perspectives. I don't know if you have brief time for one or two questions. It would be nice if someone wanted to comment or ask, but I'm afraid we'll have to stop quite promptly after that. Yes, please.
I think I...
No, but people will not hear otherwise.
This the question I really have to ask is not necessarily just to do with particularly Schubert's Lieder, there's quite a lot of interesting writing around how Schubert recycles ideas throughout his music. You know, the piano sonata in A major, for instance, a classic example, which refers back sometimes to song, or and the first impromptu with the opening G, and then the Elking sort of repetition of it all the time. And I just wonder, I think it has a very interesting analytical approach to Schubert, and, you know, interpreting perhaps sometimes interpreting is the wrong word, but what is going on, you know, I don't know if you've read a book by Frisk, I think it is Charles Frisk, Returning Cycles. Yes. And that, to me, I feel has an enormous relevance to Schubert and, you know, maybe even from, you know, from certainly an analytical point of view. Mm. And Edward Cohn is another one who wrote about particularly the Unfinished Symphony. You know, it's a rather humorous one. You need long ears to listen to Schubert or something, or composers need long ears, as do listeners. Mm. But I'm just interested, you know, and perhaps, sorry if I'm going on a bit, how does that affect perhaps your playing of music or Schubert and Schumann and so on?
Yeah, it's a very, very interesting question you're getting towards. Schubert really, I think, no matter what he was composing, whether quartets or symphonies, or he was profoundly a lyricist, writing melodies wherever he went. Mm. So the whole notion of a singing voice is never really absent in Schubert for a very long time. On the other hand, the length, that's what he is, Edward Cohen is referring to, the long ears, is the length of the some of the works, are almost inhuman. So the presence of a human voice in those works is developed towards something much more abstract than the real songs, so to speak, the real songs.
Thank you very much, Father.
Thank you very much to everybody for being here with us.